Today is October 28th. My name is Emily Jacobson from the New York Public Library. We're interviewing Johnny White, who served in the United States Army.
My name is Johnny White. I served in the military army. I enlisted in the Army in 1952. And from that, I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina for basic training. I also went to Fort Benning, Georgia for airborne training. And from that, I washed out of airborne training because I was told that if you wash out two times, it's a possibility to let you stay in Fort Benning and be a cadre. So first time I washed out, they put me in the S4 section, and I liked that, so I stayed there. Then they said, oh no. I told them I couldn't read, I couldn't write, I couldn't understand nothing. They said, fine, we understand that. So since you don't understand anything and you can't read, we are going to send you to Korea. So it was two of us together, Richard Singleton and myself. So we got to quit this game. They have our record. They know we went to school. They know we can read. They know we can write. So we went to Japan. It took us maybe 17 or 18 days from Seattle to Japan. When we got there, there were so many ships in the harbor because there was a storm and they couldn't get to Korea, so they divided. That's what they told us. So I went to Japan. I went to a place called Sendai, Japan. It's in the northern Honshu of Japan. It's just where you had the last tsunami. That's where I was stationed. It was one of the coldest places in the world. But we were trained and drilled and trained over and over. I stayed there from September of 1952 until May of 1953. We trained in cold weather. We trained jungle training. We had all training that pertained to Korean War. We were training psychological warfare, how to survive if you were captured, what to do, what to say. And I was trained with some of the best men that I believe that ever fought in a war. I served with the first group of men that went to Korea. They were part of a unit called Task Force Smith. And I think it's, they were from the 24th Division. They were the first one to send to Korea. And they were unprepared. They were undertrained. They didn't have the right equipment. They didn't know the language. They know the culture, but not the language, and were not prepared for that war. That is the saying of that group of men from 24th Division, which now I'm a member of. They said to me that they were probably outnumbered 100-1 on every front, but because of the training that they received during the Second World War, helped them to survive. The time, that period, maybe 7 or 8 days that they had to fight without getting any support. So I learned a lot from a guy by the name of Philip Zapier. He was Mexican. And there's another person I learned a lot from. He was from Arkansas. His name was Blair, Sergeant Blair. To me, I learned more from those men while I was in Japan, than I learned probably for the rest of my time in the military. After we leave in Sendai, Japan, and we went to Busan, Incheon, I forgot where we landed when we got to Korea. The thing that I will always remember, it was on a Wednesday, it was raining, and they heard the siren, and they said, everyone clear the barracks, all your equipment was either white or red alert. I don't remember the code. But when we lined up, they call our name on, the first person name that I can remember calling out of my platoon was Johnny White. And normally the military go alphabetically down. And they said to me, you are now in charge of the 81mm mortar, I think it was section. What is this? Then I realized that we were going to Korea. Then they divided us. All the old timers, they stayed in Japan, and I could see tears coming down their faces because they knew where we were going. And I can say this, it was the first time in my life that I was afraid, because I was afraid of the unknown. I didn't believe what these guys were saying was true. But after that Wednesday, I can't even remember what we had for lunch, and that's why I don't like it today, franken beans. And the water was coming in the canteen and in the mess kit. And I didn't even need it. But now I wish I needed it, because it was a long time before we got another hot meal. I think it was 21 of us in an 81 mortar platoon section. We had a gun section, we had the FDC section. I don't remember the officer name we had. I don't remember. I don't remember if the officer was assigned to us, but we had a first sergeant in Japan. His name was Jahangi. He was a really, really tough guy. I can remember a company commander had by the name, his name just slipped me. He was an excellent officer. So, with the training that I had and the background that I listened to from my grandparents and the older people who served during the First World War, and reminiscing that how the Civil War was fought, I said, you know, if those people that I'm thinking about, if my grandfather, the name of Perry Williams, or Conrad Wiley, or Aiken. I said, another man, I think name was Mr. Cuthbert and Mr. Ferguson. They were all from Hilton Head, and they served during the First World War. And I remember on Hilton Head, there was a gun place, on the fort we used to call it, and I heard people say, you know, my grandfather, my great-grandfather ran the powder house, or he ran the battery. So I said to myself, if those people made it, they couldn't read or write, they didn't know the language well, if they survive, I'm going to survive. Then that brought memories back to me, but the guys that fought in the Second World War. I had an uncle, James White. I had another very good friend, J.B. Grant, Eugene Wiley, William Ferguson, John Brown. These were the people that I remember when they went to war, and when they Tom Barnwell, Edward Barnwell. I remember them, and I said to myself, well, they made it back. Nothing happened to them that I know of. And the only two people I remember dying in the Second World War got killed was Rufus Rivers and another person who was a Brown. They were from Hilton Head. So I said, my odds of coming back now are great. And you remember things that people were saying to you. I remember my grandfather, named Benjamin White. He did not like the Army. And he said to me, when I went in the military, he said, do not be a chicken plucker. It's a chicken plucker. So he told me. A chicken plucker was a cook, because the majority, it was the military, and the majority of the cooks were black. And he said, after the war, the man was a cook. I think it was during the Civil War. He was a cook. But he could cook chicken, he could cook this, he had everything. And he was very proud of it. But when the war was over, he didn't have a job. He couldn't cook, he didn't have a pot, and he didn't have a chicken. The only thing he could say to the world, that I was in the Army, and I was a cook. So he said to me, you know, if you're going into the Army, make sure that you do not be a chicken plucker. So I remember that. And when we got to Korea, it was good to see a chicken plucker, because we did not, after we left, we went to Busan, and we got on the ship, or LST, like the one I showed you. And this, I think that's the picture that they capture that, because one of the sad part about the Korean War, it was integrated. The military was then integrated. Mm-hmm. So when I went in 1952, it was integrated. But when we got to Japan, I mean to Korea, after going through all the villages, and I saw loads, and I saw men, like, they were cows. They were just thrown on boxcar. They were screaming. But they all had a sense of humor, although they was wounded. They were saying to you, when you get up there, get one for me. That means when you get up to the front line, make sure you kill one person just for me. Or someone will say, hey, look, give me your name and address of your family so I can tell them you're not coming back. So, and it was at night. And that's when I realized that everything that I'd learned was probably true. That war is hell. And it is nothing to play with. I remember they're showing us how, in fact, it took us to the place where they dropped the atomic bomb twice to let us see exactly, when I was in Japan, exactly what war can do and how it destroy individual, family, it can, a nation. Mm-hmm. Well, it destroyed Japan to the place they don't even have an army. You know, so, and I saw that, and then going up to the front line, I said, you know, what am I fighting for? Am I fighting for the guy next to me? Am I fighting for myself? Am I fighting for my family? Am I fighting for my state? And I said, you're fighting for all the above and those who fought before you. All those that was at Bunker Hill, Gettysburg, all those things that you read about in history that didn't pay attention, that's the reason why you were fighting. You were fighting for a cause greater than yours. That at that time, you don't have a chance to pick up a telephone to call them and ask why. So that's the background that I received when I got to Korea. I believe, I don't know, it was on a Thursday evening that we got to, I don't know, I forgot the name of the town we went to, we were assigned. But we relieved another very proud unit. We replaced a unit, I believe it was a 45th Division. I know it was a National Guard unit. I don't know what state, maybe they were from Oklahoma, I don't remember. But they were all relatives because when we got their names, they were all the names, they had a lot of similar names. But we could understand that. And they said to us that we're going on duty we're going to have the guard, we're going to relieve them. So I thought, in my thinking, that we would relieve them at 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the morning. So they give us that order, a fragment order, and they said that no, we're going to relieve them at their next shift. So I said, okay, all right. Not knowing that the next shift would be at 12 o'clock at night, not 8 o'clock in the morning, because the days start at 1 minute after 12. So that was the first real, now we was in a place, we just had a hot meal. The chicken plucker just made us a very good meal. So what we did, we took our assignment. They said we wasn't really on the front line, but we was in the area far enough to consider the combat area, because it was a dangerous zone. So we had security of the weapon depot, gas. Those three assignments we had. I took the first assignment. I volunteered my platoon to have the first assignment. So I said, you sure? I said, yeah. I said, I tell you what, I volunteered myself also to be with that. I said, okay, fine. So our first assignment was security guard for that evening or that morning. And I had the 2 o'clock. I had the 2 to 4 assignment. First, I had my weapon. I had all the, you know, everything they know about the Geneva Convention orders, what you should do, what you can do. But they didn't tell us how to distinguish the enemy from the friendly force, because the uniform was practically, they were different. But the civilians, they all were black. And you couldn't tell the North Korean from the South Korean. All I know that they knew that we was from the 24th Division, and they did not like the 24th Division because they were the first one there. The 24th Division didn't like them because General Dean there, the commanding general, was the only general that was captured during the Korean War. And for them, that was a disgrace to our division, or to the United States, or to the UN. But it was a great rallying point for them, for the enemy. So maybe an hour after I was on duty, I saw a person coming, and I challenged them, and I gave them the sign and cosign. The guy stopped, but he couldn't answer me, and I didn't have the strength or the energy I put to pull the trigger. And as I was watching this guy, I heard something on my right. There was a person on my left. They had me surrounded. And there was no use in firing the weapon. So I said, well, I got off easy. I'm going to be captured, because the war's almost over. And they passed by me and tapped me on the shoulder, and in perfect English, they said, comrade, you have no right here, and walked away. That was my first experience that this thing is very serious, and how you train, and as long as you train, there's certain things you're not prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my lesson, that I went back, and maybe 2 weeks later, I told the guys what happened. And by that time, we had gotten used to Korea. And every day, they were telling us, you know, next week, they're going to sign the treaty. Next week is the treaty. And we would have the propaganda, but we were training and training. And then we had another alert. It said Syngman Rhee, president of South Korea, had turned out all the prisoner of war, all the civilian prisoner that he had kept in captivity, North Korean or South Korean, we didn't know who they were. He was opened the gate and let them all out. So they gave us that assignment, that we were put on alert, called the blocking position, to gather all the prisoners of war, all the civilians that were let loose. So that was, because you didn't know who was who. But I can say the guys that I was with and I was training with, they were the best. Never lost a man, never court-martialed a man. And we had a lot of fights, but no one else could jump in. That was part of the training and part of growing up and trying to defend. We were fighting for a set of people we never knew, place we only read about, to see if democracy was a way of life at that particular place and time. I also would say that I asked myself the question, if I was MacArthur, how would I have fought the war? Mm-hmm. And if I was Truman, how would I command? How would I command? Knowing what I know now, I would say they had a very tough decision to make, and really unpopular considering what the man did in the First World War, in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
But we learn every day, and even today, 60 years later, we are still engaged in the war, because I don't believe that America have been a country long enough to appreciate what they have to compare to the rest, to the Koreans, the Chinese, everyone. History or culture are larger than ours,
mm-hmm.
and they have a different outlook on it. But the last, I would say the saddest day to me is the day that the war was, when they said the war was over.
Mm.
Because, in my opinion, we knew what we had went through.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know now if everyone got the message that the war was over. We didn't know if the unit next to us, because since we had 21 different countries in the war,
mm-hmm.
we don't know if the Turks got the message that the war was over. We don't know if the North Korean got the message that the war was over. Or we know that the night before, everybody was fine. All the ammunition they could find, and I mean, it was just like, although we was farther back, because the skies were like red and blue and gray. But because they didn't want to take their weapon or the ammunition back, or just what arrangement was made by our headquarters. But I met a lot of good friends in the military. I'm still a member of the Korean War Veterans Association, the KVA. And it's an experience that if you survive, it's, but a lot of people didn't survive. When the war was over, the other challenge was the exchange of prisoners.
Mm.
I was interested in it because I had an uncle, Charlie White. He served during the Korean War. During the Korean War, I had two uncles, three first cousins, and a brother that served during the Korean War. But our famous family member was Charlie White. He was a driver for one of the UN teams that are negotiating the ceasefire at Panmunjom. So, in the Stars and Stripes, I think it was September or October 1952, I think that was a big headline in the Stars and Stripes, which I'm still trying to get a copy, but I'll get a copy for him. He's still alive. But those were the days we went, made different stops and places and had different assignments. And my really, truly last assignment that in Korea was taken to, we was assigned to Kojido, Kojido Island. Now, Kojido is where they had a lot of prisons, right? I can only talk about the unit that I was with.
Mm-hmm.
We got, I think, the compound 79. Those were some of the toughest, hardcore prisoners that we captured, that the Americans captured, or the UN captured. And I can remember they were very, very brilliant men. I called them comrade. Anything, and they spoke perfect English. And they would say that, you know, you need to stay over here because in 10 years you'll be back. And they were right, because less than 10 years, we were back in Vietnam. But as we exchanged the prisoners, I think I made three or four trips from Kojido or Busan to Yeongdangpo or Panmunjom, where we exchanged the prisoner of war. And I saw two sides of life.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the men that we took over to exchange they had a reason why they didn't want to go back, or didn't. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, well, why wouldn't you want to go back home? They said, well, I don't know if I have a home. Because I went to school, and they plucked me up, and I was in the Army. Mm. I don't know where to go. I don't have a home. I don't have any family. I never got in touch with them. I don't know. I don't know if they're going to think that we are traitors or what. Mm. And somebody, they spoke very, very good English. And we treated them well. Mm. We followed, on Cogedor, we followed the Geneva Convention, in my opinion, to the letter. I have never seen, I don't care what they did, I have never seen, we might have gassed them, but I've never seen any bad treatment to the enemy. On the other hand, our side, when they come back, they were frail, they looked sick, but they had a good spirit. Mm-hmm. The third part of it, those who were bringing washed, they stand mm-hmm. on the other side and wave and said, we are not coming back home. They, especially, the majority of them were minority, was black. Mm-hmm. And now, I can't say that they were all Americans, because we had the Ethiopians were black. They had a lot of black nation over there. But I could not imagine from Task Force Smith up until the last day of the war, that so many Americans give their lives, they suffered, they were injured, and they decided that they will not come back because they feel they had a better life in captivity than they have. Realizing now that they are not citizens of that country, and they are not citizens of America. Mm. And I asked myself the question, how could they live with themselves or their family? Mm. Because as bad as we are, the Americans might be, we don't fight well at night. We don't fight well on holidays. Mm-hmm. And we don't fight well on Saturday and Sunday, but we can produce. So as I look back now, 60 years later, I think when history is being written, after maybe another 30 or 40 years, after all the Korean veterans are gone, the only thing you will have will be these stories. Mm-hmm. And if you compare them with other wars, I would say, if we did not stop the Koreans or the Chinese or the Communists at that juncture, Japan had no army. They would definitely land in the United States. And to prove my point, we had a revisit to Korea. I went back to Korea in 1994 just to see if war made a difference to the country, to the people, to the country. And I would say, from where I sit and look at it as a civilian, the Korean people, they are more advanced now than we are. Where they had one bridge, now they have 100. The city is built up. They are far advanced than we are. All the children are going to school. But the American kids or the mixed breed kids, they are the left out one. So although we are left, there's still a war going on, inner war going on that no one talk about. Now, I don't know, 50 years from now when you interview them, I would like to know what their story would be like. But I think that as a member of many veteran organizations, I believe that the Korean War veterans, I am very proud and honored to see I served with them during that time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.